This is the Anthrobiology Podcast, hosted by me, Gabby LaPera. Every 2 weeks, I interview a biological anthropologist about what makes us, us. Hey there, everyone. It's Gabby LaPera. Thank you for joining me for another episode of the Anthrobiology Podcast. Sorry, this one is a little bit late. I had some personal stuff come up this week, and it meant I couldn't finish editing until, well, Saturday. But I still think this episode is really, really good. I will say that this episode was very interesting for me because I actually had no idea I was going to do it until basically I recorded it. What happened was a listener heard the episode that I did with Chris Webster about CRM, and she had a very different perspective because she works in tribal archaeology, and she really wanted to share that perspective with y'all. And it's really a field that I know nothing about, which I think is very apparent both from the Chris Webster episode and from this episode with Jill McCormick. I am always open to learning more, and I hope y'all are open to learning more too. I know, again, that this isn't normally an archaeology show, but because the perspective that she brought was so different and important, I thought it was important that y'all hear it too. The other reason I wanted to do this show is because biological anthropologists frequently need to deal with native tribes in the United States. And I thought it'd be really interesting to get the perspective of an archaeologist who works so closely for the tribes, as opposed to scientists who are coming from a kind of outside perspective trying to answer research questions. So yeah, I think that you'll like it. I hope you will. If you have any questions or any feelings or anything, feel free to email me. That's how this whole episode came about anyway. Yeah. Oh, and one more note. The last show in August is also going to be kind of a weird one. It's actually going to be with a biological anthropologist, but it's going to be with a grad student. And we're going to talk a little bit about what it's like to be a grad student, mental health, that kind of stuff. I just wanted to kind of make August a little bit more of an alternative month. So we're having kind of a different month, but we'll be back to our regularly scheduled like research deep dives in September. Yeah. Oh, yes. There was actually one more thing. Actual last thing. The score of the WNBA game on August 10th, the Mercury won 91-79 against the Dallas Wings. Sure, Jill McCormick is super delighted about that. That's it. I think that's all you need to know. Enjoy the show. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Anthrobiology Podcast. This is Gabby LaPera, and joining me via Skype is actually a listener named Jill McCormick, who is the Historic Preservation Officer for the Quetzon Tribe in Yuma, Arizona. Jill, would you like to describe where that is for listeners? Because I'm a little scared too.
Yes, I can do that. The Quetzon are located right around the city of Yuma, Arizona, which is as far south and west in Arizona as you can be. We actually go into California. The Colorado River runs down through there and splits Arizona and California. So we're in Arizona and California.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. So the reason that you're actually here is because you listened to an episode that I did on CRM archaeology, and you actually emailed me and said that you do tribal CRM archaeology, which is related but different, shall we say, to CRM archaeology. And I just want to kind of put in a note for myself, which is if you email me, I do respond.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. I can attest to that, that she responds very quickly, too.
So you're here because you wanted to talk a little bit about tribal CRM, what it's like working with tribes, what it's like working with archaeologists who do purely commercial work, and kind of open up our world a little bit more. This is something that I had no idea about until you emailed me. I think I was very upfront in the last archaeology episode where I was also like, I don't know anything about CRM. This is a whole new world to me. So I'm excited to be learning more, and I'm sure listeners will be excited to learn more too. Can you start us off by telling us a little bit about what tribal CRM is?
Well, I don't know that I would call it tribal CRM, although some tribes people that do the work that I do, that is their title, cultural resource managers. But we do a lot of the work for the tribe of protecting their material culture. So as you probably, I'm pretty sure you covered this on the last episode about, you know, if a bridge goes in, a cell tower goes in, you know, solar farm, there are federal requirements that have to be met. Land has to be surveyed, that kind of thing. And that's where your CRM people come in, and they do the work for either the proponent or for the federal, state, local agency. And that kicks into also consultation with the tribes. So consultation is done not by a CRM company, which I think is a misconception by a lot of people. We consult on the tribal side, government to government. We do not consult with CRM companies. They are not government to government. So when those reports are written and we are contacted about the project, that's where I come in, and I will do the liaison work between the agency and the tribe, and I will review the CRM reports and any project documents, whether it be a NEPA document, a CEQA document.
And those two documents you just named, those are acronyms for laws, correct?
Yes. NEPA is the National Environmental Policy Act. That's the federal entity for environmental review, and CEQA is the California Environmental Quality Act, which is a California regulation that needs to be met in these instances. So I do a lot of that, you know, in my work. I have to be, I'm an archaeologist. I went to school to be an archaeologist. I am an archaeologist, but I also have to know all the federal, state, local laws, how those are applicable, how to use those laws to help the tribe to preserve cultural resources. And we have to have a knowledge, obviously, of tribal history as well. So we have to have a lot of different pieces within our basket of knowledge. You know, we aren't just archaeologists. We have to be able to almost sometimes be a lawyer.
Right.
or be a facilitator at meetings. You know, we do a lot of different things working in these positions.
So let me make sure I understand. Say someone wants to build a shopping mall, and there are federal laws that, or state laws potentially also, that exist that say you have to do some archaeological work and some environmental work to make sure there's nothing there that's important. A CRM company, an outside CRM company, comes in and does that, writes a report, and then they hand it over to you.
Well, they don't hand it over to me. Let's say they're doing it for a shopping mall in your example. That shopping mall is most likely on either state, county, city land.
Mm-hmm.
They would be doing the CRM firm would be doing the work for that entity. And it's an entity's job, the agency's job, to make sure that that work is done at a certain level, and that they reach out and consult with the tribes and the public, you know, for this project. They would send us initial consultation letter, letting us know what's going on. Then, you know, we would know that there's going to be more documents that will be coming for the project, and those will be sent to us to review, and we have to respond accordingly.
So what kind of things do you look for in that documentation?
A lot. If it's a cultural resource report, which I'm going to start off right off the bat that I do not like that term, cultural resource report, because there's nothing cultural about it. It's basically, even in California that has AB 52 requirements that they have to assess tribal cultural resources and have tribal input, a lot of times it doesn't happen. So these reports are mostly scientific. They're from a different perspective. There's nothing cultural in there. There's no cultural aspects of the tribe. The tribes aren't, you know, involved a lot of times in the writing of those reports. But when we get them, what I'm looking for generally is, you know, first off, project location, where's it at? I'm reading through the cultural context or the cultural history sections, because a lot of times these reports don't accurately reflect the range of cultures that would be tied to this location per their traditional lands. So I'm reading through there to make sure that it's covering, you know, if it's a Quetzon tribe, you know, that they're in there, if it's one of their areas that they claim as traditional lands, that they're in there. And then basically kind of going through the site records, the recording of the sites, looking to make sure that they have accurately recorded the sites, they've done a good job with the recording, that they've met the site criteria, because every state has a different site criteria. So, you know, you have to make sure that they've assessed it, because they're making recommendations of National Register eligibility, which gives some level of protection to the sites if they are National Register eligible. So I'm looking for a range of things that way. I'm also taking that information, compiling my own notes from my review, and then I discuss it with our Tribal Cultural Committee. That's made up with members of the Quetzal Tribe. And then we'll take that to the Tribal Council and inform them of the project and get their recommendations also on what to do going forward.
Right. So presumably if they find nothing, then shopping mall goes forward. What happens if they do find something, and like what happens to the materials that they find? What happens with potentially their project? Like, is that something that can be stopped, or what happens next?
Funny you should ask that. I'm involved in a project right now. This is one of those cases where I can't be lollipops and sugar canes for CRM. We have a project. I can't give too many details out, but it's a larger project that's going to do a lot of ground disturbing here in Imperial County, just west of where we are, but still within the traditional lands. It's off the reservation, but it's still within the traditional lands of the tribe. So it's a joint federal state project. So it's a NEPA and CEQA project. This project, the CRM company did a horrible job. They did not assess the site correctly. They did not assess the ceramics correctly. They say that the site is ineligible. So, you know, when I'm reading through that report and looking at that report, you know, like I just said a few minutes ago, that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking to see what they've put in there, what they've recorded, how they've assessed what they've recorded. And, you know, in this instance, my spidey senses went off because I see that they inaccurately typed the ceramics that are at the site, which ceramics are in this area are my thing. I'm a ceramicist.
And I'm just going to interrupt you real quick. The reason that archaeologists love ceramics and like all of this like material culture stuff so much is that it helps date the site, and it also helps understand kind of cultural affiliation. So mistyping the ceramics is actually a really big deal.
Exactly. And I'll tell you how much of a big deal it is. I'll try to make this very, very short, but this has been going on for months and months. The CRM company actually did their survey, produced a report. I read the report, was not happy with the report. Then a few weeks later went out and did a site visit to the area. And not only did they mistype the ceramics, but they also did not record everything that was there. They had a site that was probably 30 meters by 50 meters. When I went out there, I found a site three times as big that they did not record. Many, many, many more ceramics, many more lithics.
And lithics are basically stones that have been shaped by humans in some way, shape, or form.
Yes. Yes. So this site, in my analysis, and when I brought this up to the proponent of the project, they then asked me to write an independent assessment of the site, since I had such a vastly different view of this site than they did. And based on my assessment, they are now trying to rework the site. They're trying to move it away from the site. But the finale here is the way that this really impacts the tribes is that this site, come to find out, we have ceramics out there that are over 1,000 years old. We have two different wares and at least 8 to 10 different types of ceramics and lithics at this site. So we have a long-term habitation site here. And this company just basically blew it off. Had I not taken the extra time and really dove into this project, that site would have been completely destroyed and we'd no longer have it. Their project would have plowed right through it and there would have been nothing. So that's why I'm not a big fanboy of a lot of the CRM companies, because their work does affect tribes in a very personal way. I think a lot of times the CRM companies don't really feel like the tribes are still involved, or they don't really think that tribes are still existent. and that they care about these places. So they are. Tribes still exist. They are still here. They still care about these resources very deeply. It ties into their past, ties into their ancestors. So it really bugs me when, good work is not done. And a lot of tribes, you only have one person in the position that I am. Some, luckily they may have more, five or six people in their office, but a lot of times it's one person trying to take care of all these projects. And it is a lot because we get projects from three different states, from multiple BLM offices, from multiple counties in both Arizona and California.
Yes, I think that one of the things that I'm hearing, one of the big differences between commercial CRM and what you do is that you get to work with one tribe. And so you have like really deeply immersed yourself in the history, the material culture. Sorry, I keep saying material culture and I don't know if listeners know what that is. Material culture is the physical remains that a culture or a group leaves behind in terms of objects. So this isn't like bones or like any human remains. These are literally like a cup that someone used to drink tea out of, or a brick, or any, or like a fork or something. Anyway, any of that can be a cultural remain, or a material culture rather. Oof, it's been a long time since I've thought about archaeology. So like the real difference is like you can really drill down deep and like really acquire this vast depth and wealth of knowledge in your area. What makes CRM firms potentially very ineffective is that they are, and this is something that Chris also said, that they're constantly moving state to state, project to project. Mm-hmm. So they might find stuff and not really understand what it is. And that can lead to the destruction of some really important sites. Yeah.
I would say that that's what makes them dangerous to tribal entities, because a lot of archaeologists don't understand the power that they have in what they're doing, because they're essentially writing people's history when they're doing these reports and when they're doing their work. They are writing the history of another group of people. Mm-hmm. And if you don't understand that group of people and you inaccurately write their history, that has major implications.
Right. This is the kind of double-edged sword of historic anthropology. So both biological anthropology and archaeology, it gives people the power to give a voice to people who don't have written records. But at the same time, that's a huge responsibility, because you have to interpret something where the original peoples gave no guidance as to how they perceived events. So on one hand, like for me, I grew up in the South, and I did a lot of like colonial history and things like that. A lot of our understanding, for example, of what slaves experienced in slave culture comes from archaeology, not from written records, because the written records are very, very biased generally. Like they come from one perspective, which is that of the plantation owners. So having archaeology available in order to do that is huge, but at the same time, we have to understand that we are piecing together a history from just physical objects as opposed to anything written.
Exactly. And a lot of times when they are writing their reports or they're recording sites, if we don't agree with them, if the tribe doesn't agree with them, it's on the tribe then to legitimize their views and to legitimize their history, which is wholly incorrect. That it shouldn't be that way, but that's the way it normally works out, is that the CRM firms or the archaeologists are more listened to about a people's history than the actual people. That's one of the things that we really need to change is, on a lot of these site forms, they have a section when you're recording a site for interpretations. That's one thing that we've been working to try to change, is that section of those reports that has interpretations should not be written by an archaeologist. That should be written by tribal people. That should be telling their thoughts about what this site is, if they choose to do that, if they want to do that, and their interpretations, and not only the tangible aspects of what's there, but the intangible. the way our system is right now, the harm that it does to tribes. It forces them to legitimize their views. I mean, I've actually sat in meetings where federal officials talk about their religion, but then when the tribal members talk about their beliefs, their religious beliefs, they have to legitimize them. And this happens, you know, from CRM up all the way up the chain. I can't blame CRM for everything because there's a lot of federal officials that
right. I think,
cause a lot of problems.
I think potentially your issue might be with the system that's in place rather than with
it's
individuals.
System, yeah.
Generally.
The system that we have does not serve both sides equally. And tribes are treated like objects to study. You know, when you get your archaeological survey report, you know, you have research questions in there. And I've been reviewing two or three big reports here recently, and they have, you know, they've proposed research questions that surround sacred sites. Now, how are they going to answer those questions without the tribe? I mean, an archaeologist can't answer the question of why this place is important, or even if it is, they may not even be looking at the right sites, but they've somehow deemed those as what they call ceremonial sites or something, and then they want to answer the question of what makes this a ceremonial site, what makes this a sacred area.
See, that's really interesting to me because so a lot of the archaeologists that I have talked to in the past, they're working on sites where it's like prehistoric peoples in England or something, right? Like those people just don't exist anymore. So the best they can do is hypothesize, and like they're pretty upfront about that. They're like, we think it was this thing, but we don't really know. I feel like I've never read an archaeology paper, like in a big journal anyway, that's not like, well, we're going to say it's this, but, you know, pending further information, who knows, it might change. It's interesting to me because I feel like a lot of those archaeologists like wish they could talk to the people from those sites. Like they wish that they could know. And I feel like the tribes are a huge resource in the case of the archaeology being done in the Southwest.
And they're not being utilized. That, you know, I've asked this many, many times. If you're going to develop research questions, why don't you ask the tribes? Maybe there's questions that they would like to have answered. Maybe they would like to be involved in some of the information, but they're never asked. They're treated as a research topic, something to, you know, gather information about, not as a viable existing cultural group of people.
So one thing I actually also wanted to ask you about was Chris Webster mentioned something about tribal monitoring. So like when they're actually out there doing some of the archaeology, a member of the tribe is out there. How does that work?
Yeah, the project that he was talking about, he was working with one of the monitors that I trained when I worked with the Kokopa tribe. So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. It's a way for the tribes to be involved in the survey portion, you know, so that they can have a voice in what's going on and how things are being recorded. Unfortunately, a lot of times, you don't have enough tribal monitors out there on a lot of projects. You may only have one for, you know, two or three different areas that are being surveyed. But generally, we try to find people that are within the tribe that are interested in learning about their history and their culture. And in the case of where I work now, they do interact somewhat with the cultural committee. So, and they're kind of my eyes and ears out there, too. When we know that there's a survey or there's a big project coming up and there will be a survey, that's a chance that we say, okay, we want somebody out there. We know there's going to be sites out there, so we want somebody out there to watch what's going on and to be able to give their input into what's being recorded. Now, that's what their job is. And then generally when they find something, or if there's something that the tribal monitor may have questions about, or they, you know, hey, I don't think they're doing something right, that's where they would call us, say, you know, well, wait a minute, that's not the way what they're supposed to be doing. You know, they need to do this, this, and this. So it's a symbiotic relationship where, you know, I need the monitors and they need me. It gives them a chance to kind of try to test out archaeology too. And if they want to become an archaeologist, which is something I always promote, I'd love to see a lot more younger Native kids wanting to be archaeologists and kind of turning the tables on that so that we have more of that voice out there.
Yeah. I think that, like a lot of areas in anthropology, this is an area that still needs a substantial amount of work. I hope, though, that in general, things are slowly moving in the right direction. I feel like the passage of things like NAGPRA, so the Native Americans Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. Sorry, I say things and I realize that I was like, no one knows what a NAGPRA is.
I talk in acronyms all the time.
Yeah. Or more like on the state level, like we've mentioned CEQA a couple times. That's the California Environmental Protection Act. Hopefully those are kind of like top down things that are kind of hopefully changing a little bit the way that anthropologists and Native communities interact. But then there's also a lot of work to be done within anthropology itself to get archaeologists and anthropologists to connect more deeply with the tribes. It does sound like things are improving, but we do have a very long way to go.
Yeah. And it's the monitoring has taken a long time to get started, and it is not across the board by any means. We work here in Imperial County with our local BLM office starting back probably 10 years ago now.
Oh, just in case people don't know, BLM stands for Bureau of Land Management.
Oh, sorry.
It's okay. Someone asked me the other day what it stood for because they had only heard of Black Lives Matter. And I was like,
yes,
it is the Bureau of Land Management.
Yeah. Sorry. As I said, I talk in acronyms a lot, but we've been working, here locally for probably over 10 years to try to get this program going within all the projects within this area. Now, it's not across the board. We only have it in a few locations. When you come into Arizona, which we work a lot in Arizona too, it's not as across the board. You only get the tribal monitors kind of here and there. It's kind of hit and miss, and we have to fight very hard in some cases to get them to allow, because the proponent essentially has to pay for it. There is no legal basis for tribal monitors, so they can't legally make them, make the project proponent pay to have tribal monitors on site. So that's part of one of the things with the laws that we need to change is to.
Yeah, definitely. I think this is like a greater issue of capitalism and money. But I think that the only way to, and this is something that Chris also said, that he wishes that all projects required tribal monitors, because then it would be written into the cost of the project and it would be something that no one would try and undercut each other by just like cutting out the cost of the tribal monitor.
Now, one thing I did want to clear up that I did hear in his interview was he made a comment that the tribal monitor would tell them what to do with something. I couldn't quite catch everything he said there, but no, that is not what a tribal monitor is to do. There is still that higher level consultation. No CRM firm is out there surveying and deciding what to do with artifacts. Mm-hmm. They're simply there as data collectors gathering information, and then there's a whole nother process that goes on outside of that. They make their recommendations of eligibility, and then they're pretty much done. Then it comes to our side, and we do the review, and we work with the agencies, and we say whether we agree with those determinations or not, and there's a lot of back and forth between the agency and the tribes that goes on well after those reports are written.
Yeah, so this actually sounds like another major difference between what the CRM firms do and what you do, which is the CRM firms, like you said, they're there for data collection, they write their report, and then they leave. It sounds like you get to really dive deep into the sites and like actually understand what's going on. And for people who...
To a degree.
Yeah. But for people who want to know kind of the rest of the story, as opposed to just like doing the data collection, like that would be definitely something that might sway you towards the kind of archaeology you do rather than CRM.
Yeah. The only bad thing about it is you don't get a lot of wins when you have to see things being destroyed. That really takes a toll on you, or when you have to go back and tell the elders that, hey, I'm sorry, we can't we can't stop this project. You know, I wish I knew more, did my job better, whatever. You know, you take it's very personal to you that, you know, you have to go back and look in the face of somebody that means a great deal to and tell them that, no, it's going to be destroyed. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not a good part of this job is to have to watch things constantly be destroyed. And you get a win every once in a while, like the project I was talking about. Hopefully it's looking like we're going to get a win and this site is not going to be destroyed. We're actually going to be going out there next week with a new set of archaeologists and resurveying the areas.
Yeah, I can see how that could definitely take a toll on an individual.
It does. And I've had to have those discussions in the past with my monitors. You're going to be sky high when you first start, and you're going to feel really good. And then you're going to go through a time where you're going to hit a wall, because it feels like nothing is going right, and you're just going to go into a deep, deep depression for a while. And, you know, you got to kind of try to pull yourself out, and because it is hard. It's hard to watch this stuff be destroyed and have people not understand that it's not just the tribe's history. You know, like this site I'm talking about, you know, that's over a thousand years of history. That's history for California. That's history for the United States. That's tribal history. We should all be interested in that. You can go out there and see artifacts and see a place where people were there over 1,000 years ago, living their life just like we're living our lives now. I know I'm geeking out, but to me, that's incredibly, incredibly cool. And it ties you to something to see that, you know, you can sit there and you can imagine the people being there.
Yeah.
And that they were living just like you're living now, you know.
I think that's a big part of the magic of archaeology. You know, I think that's why I was always really interested in history and archaeology when I first started, is because it was like you were touching a piece of history.
You can put your thumb in the thumbprint of a piece of ceramics where somebody made it 1,000 years ago. You know, that's just incredibly cool.
Yeah, you feel it in your chest when that happens. Speaking of which, if a student were interested in kind of going down this track, how would they go about getting started? Like, would they need to get their master's or PhD? Like, what kinds of things would someone need to do?
You really don't need to have a PhD. It depends on the tribe, what each tribe is looking for, because every tribe has different criteria. You know, a degree is obviously good for some portions of what you would be doing, but they don't teach a lot of this stuff in school. You know, I mean, you can go and get your archaeology degree, and not many colleges teach about CRM or CRM law, preservation law. So that would be something that you would need to know, and there's lots of places you can find information on that. One of the biggest things is to learn about, if you're interested in the specific area, learn about that tribe, you know, because that's the people you're going to be working with, and learn about them. Most tribes have websites, so you can get on there. They may have a history section or a contact section, and I get a lot of emails that get forwarded to me from the website, that, you know, people asking questions and things like that. So knowing archaeology, you obviously need to know some of that if you're going to be, you know, doing the work that I do. That would be, you know, a lot of it. You can learn some of it by, you know, Tom King has a lot of books out there on cultural resource management, Claudia and Nisley as well. They produce one book at least together about CRM laws. So you can learn a lot through books like that. And, you know, you can also go talk to somebody from a tribe. Go ask somebody, you know, hey, can I come with you and learn?
Listeners, I think this is like a super underrated piece of advice. I cannot tell you how open anthropologists are to people who want to learn more about what they do. I don't know how y'all think that I get people on the show, but I literally just email them and I'm like, can you talk to me for an hour? And they're like, sure. I have only had one person say no to me.
Because usually nobody wants to talk to us. You know, we're out in the desert talking to trees and rocks and stuff. And so if somebody wants to listen to us.
Exactly. People get so excited to share what they do. So like, if it's something that you're really interested in, just send an email to someone who's already in the field doing whatever it is that you want to do. The same advice actually applies for anyone who wants to go to grad school. Email the potential advisors that you've identified. People are going to want to talk to you and tell you about their experience. That is great advice, I think. And also, you managed to answer the first question that I was going to ask you about books, which is, if people are interested in learning more, what should they read? So excellent segue and good job. So can I ask you, what are you reading for work right now?
Oh, lots of archaeological reports, several NEPA documents, several EISs, EIRs, which is the CEQA component, environmental impact statement for NEPA, and environmental impact report for CEQA. Nothing really exciting. It's all it's all work related, and a little bit of papers on ceramics. Mm-hmm. You know, just keeping my ceramic side up so I can stay fresh.
Yeah, you gotta keep up with the field. So
I forgot one more thing that's very important. Every morning I start with the Federal Register. I get an email from the Federal Register. So I read that every morning to see if there's any new EISs, changes in laws, or anything that are being proposed. So that's how I start my day at 4 in the morning.
Oh my gosh. You must be a morning person.
Yes, I am.
I feel like that is very admirable. My mother is a morning person too. She's up super early every day. And I feel like by the time I stumble downstairs, bleary eyed, she's like, good morning. I've like made breakfast and I've already had like 2 work calls and I've already done all this stuff. And I'm like, yeah. I've slept.
She goes to bed at 8 o'clock probably.
Yes, she does. And I stay up until the wee hours of the morning. I find that I do most of my work between like 8 p.m. and like 1 a.m. So
it takes all kinds.
I just have a completely offset schedule from the rest of the world, which is fine. Speaking of what I do in my off hours, what do you consume for fun right now?
I am watching the WNBA religiously since the season started a few weeks ago. Mercury. Phoenix Mercury.
Listeners,
Phoenix Mercury.
You can't see this, but she's wearing a t-shirt with the Mercury logo on it. I love that. Go WNBA.
They have a game tonight, so I gotta represent game tonight.
It is August 10th, so by the time that this show goes live, I will know the score and I'll put it at the beginning.
Okay, good. One thing, and then I'm also reading a couple of different books. If I could recommend one that's really good that would probably go along with the question you asked before about what to read. Many Nations Under Many Gods, Public Land Management and American Indian Sacred Sites by Todd Allen Moorman. It's a very good book. It goes through a lot of different case studies of tribes fighting to protect sacred areas, and the Quetzal are actually in there for a couple of different projects that they went to federal court and won. One of them they won. So that would be a good book. Maybe you could put that in your show notes if somebody's wanting to learn. That gives you, would give you a little bit of information about some of the things that tribes fight for and have to fight for.
Definitely. We can definitely include that.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you so much for spending the time talking to me today. Thank you so much for emailing me and letting me know that there is more to the story than I originally thought. I really appreciate it. And I hope you have a wonderful day and good luck with all of your projects.
All right. Well, thank you. And thank you for answering my email so quickly and asking me to come on. And I could talk about this forever. I could go on for another hour. So I'll just be quiet now. And
it's good to see people who love what they do.
Yes. I would say that this is a calling. It's not just something that you like to do. You have to do it 24/7 and you have to have a calling for it.
Mm-hmm, certainly. All right, then. I will let you go and thank you so much. Okay. Thanks for joining me for this episode of the Anthrobiology Podcast. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me at gabby.lapera@anthrobiology.com. That's spelled gaby.lapera@anthrobiology.com. This show was produced and edited by me. Music courtesy of Chad Crouch, a.k.a. Poddington Bear, at Sound of Picture.